Macmillan Audio presents The Secret History of Twin Peaks by Mark Frost. Read by David Patrick Kelly, Annie Wershing, Michael Horse, Robert Knepper, Russ Tamblin, Mark Frost, Amy Shields, Matt Hostetler, James Morrison, Len Carreyou, Chris Mulkey, Arthur Bishop, Ari Fliakos, and Kyle MacLachlan.
Federal Bureau of Investigation, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Office of the Deputy Director. Inter-Office Memorandum. Date, 8-4-2016. From Gordon Cole, Deputy Director, to Special Agent. Dear Agent, the accompanying material is confidential and approved for your eyes only. The enclosed dossier was recovered on 7-17-2016 from a crime scene that is still under active investigation. All details of this situation are classified 3 levels above top secret. It is being given to you for comprehensive analysis, cataloging, and cross-referencing content against all known databases under Code Red measures. We need to learn and verify the person or persons responsible for compiling this dossier, and we need to know it yesterday. Background. The content of the dossier appears to have some relationship to an investigation conducted in Northwest Washington State many moons ago by Special Agent Dale Cooper, who worked under my command at that time. The case involved a series of homicides in and around a small town called Twin Peaks, most notably the murder of a young woman named Laura Palmer. That case is considered closed, but aspects of it may be relevant to your work, so we are granting you access to all of Agent Cooper's files and tapes. Also attached is a document highlighting previous processing of the dossier by Bureau personnel. Roll up your sleeves and get to work on this thing. Time is of the essence, and get back to me with your findings ASAP. Sincerely yours, Gordon Cole, Deputy Director Gordon Cole. P.S. When you get done with this, come see me immediately. By then I may have more for you to do. Federal Bureau of Investigation, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Classified. Date, 8-4-2016. Topic, Dossier Processing Timeline. Submitted by Cole, Gordon. Synopsis of Facts. The following dossier was recovered on Date Redacted. Time and location noted, but are classified as strictly need to know. Field agents, names redacted. Discovered dossier while on assignment in redacted. It was recovered from a crime scene that is still classified as unsolved and may have relevance to a previous crime or crimes in 1991 that is similarly classified. Dossier was submitted to director on 7-17-2016. Dossier referred by Director to Investigations and Operations Support Section, IOSS, on 7-20-2016. Special Agent T.P. will begin analysis and report on validity. All work will be conducted and dossier will be kept in clean room at FBI HQ. Stated priority, identify person or persons who compiled dossier. Confirmed. Special Agent T.P. has completed all required background checks and filed completed forms SF-86 and FD-258. Confirmed, Special Agent T.P. adjudicated for top secret security clearance as of 2009 and approved for adjunct liaison with Special Task Force B and all related files per Crypto Clearance 12. Confirmed, Special Agent T.P. will report exclusively to Head of Special Task Force B and to Director. Confirmed, Special Agent T.P. begins first analysis on 8-5-16. All comments and annotations will be included and initialed. Approved, Gordon Cole. Classified. Do not write in these spaces, August 21st, 2016. Copy on file, 89. 89-69, 2041.
Federal Bureau of Investigation, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Analyst introductory remarks. The following constitute my thoughts after a cursory examination of the dossier and ahead of beginning the work at hand. Means, methodology, and motivation for the compilation of these documents and ephemera will be commented upon throughout and initialed TP as separate entries in the margins. All content is presented here in the order in which it appears in the original dossier without revision. This order of the documents, as far as can be ascertained at first glance, appears to be chronological and as a result presents a direct, if intermittent, sense of historical narrative. As to what this narrative conveys, as stated, I will present my comments throughout. The author or authors self-identifies in the body of the MS as the archivist. Given the scope of the dossier and the way in which the archivist organized it, I will attempt to offer summaries within the body of the work as I proceed. The dossier was discovered inside a carbon steel lockbox, 17 inches by 11 inches by 3 inches. Lockbox was not a standard size and does not appear to be of any known commercial manufacturer. It also features a highly sophisticated triple locking mechanism that required extensive efforts to crack. It is my considered opinion that this lockbox may have been personally fashioned by the person identified within as the archivist. The dossier itself fits snugly inside the margins of the box, further suggesting that the lockbox was custom made to accommodate it. The dossier is contained and bound within a book-shaped ledger, which also appears to be of sophisticated self-manufacture. Its embossed cover is fashioned from boards encased in dark green cloth. Initial TP. Date 8/28/16. It appears well worn, suggesting it had at some point been exposed to the elements. Nevertheless, fortunately, upon closer examination, once opened, a fully sealed and vulcanized box-like encasement around the top, bottom, and four edges kept the ledger's contents entirely free from damage. The only visible ornamentation on the entire ledger appears on the spine and is pictured at right. Measuring less than 1/2 inch and apparently hand-tooled, it depicts a series of triangles, the purpose or meaning of which at first view remains unclear. Inside the ledger itself. The documents presented inside appear to be excellent facsimiles of the originals. A few appear to be originals and, by virtue of their age, fragile. But all contents will be returned exactly as they originally appeared. Each page is covered by a clear plastic membrane, 0.02 millimeters thick, measured by digital micrometer, which appears to be of standard manufacture, although the unusual size suggests the membranes were also custom fitted. This membrane holds each document in place. No glues or tapes were used to affix the documents to the neutrally colored pages, which are all made from paper of the same uniform thickness, similar to construction paper. Initial TP, date 8/28/16. Closer examination of the edges of both the membranes and pages suggests they were cut by hand and not mass-produced. Most of the documents appear one to a page, leaving room above and below for annotations, presumably made by the archivist. These appear regularly throughout the dossier. The dossier appears to be divided into easily identified and subheaded sections. They will be presented here in their original form and order. I intend to include my own comments in the margins. These will include fact-checking, analysis, and occasionally personal reactions or comments. Whenever possible, documents will be traced to their alleged original source and verified. Any instances of documents that prove resistant to verification will be duly noted. It is my intention that engaging with the contents in this manner will achieve the stated and desired outcome, determining the identity of the archivist. Sworn and notarized before me on this day, 8/28/16, Special Agent TP. Initial TP. Date 8/28/16. The dossier.
Opening statement.
1. There is no title page, author page, table of contents, index, or appendices anywhere in the ledger. Nothing except the frequent interstitial interpretive comments by the archivist and the following opening statement, which functions as a kind of foreword before the first section, TP.
A wise man once told me that mystery is the most essential ingredient of life, for the following reason. Mystery creates wonder, which leads to curiosity, which in turn provides the ground for our desire to understand who and what we truly are. The search for meaning at the heart of life brings us to the contemplation of an internal enigma. Mysteries are the stories we tell ourselves to contend with life's resistance to our longing for answers. Mysteries abound. This continent, this country, our own earthly origins are all laden with them, underlying our existence, predating all our childish notions of history. Mythology precedes our access to historical or scientific fact, and, we know now, fulfilled much the same function for earlier civilizations, providing meaning in the face of a remorseless, indifferent universe. But in the absence of scientifically verifiable fact, it is necessary to sometimes view them as one and the same. So it is best to start at the beginning. So signed and duly sworn, the Archivist.
2. This is the only handwritten portion of the dossier, and block printing is impossible to trace to an individual. The typed sections appear to be the product of the same manual typewriter, most likely a Corona Super G, a popular, lightweight, portable model which was first manufactured in the 1970s. The dossier then simply begins with the first series of documents. T.P.
Excerpt from the expedition journals of William Clark and Meriwether Lewis. 20 September, 1805. At a distance of a mile from the lodge, I met three Indian boys. When they saw me, they ran and hid themselves in the grass. I dismounted, gave my gun and my horse to one of the men, and searched in the grass and found two of the boys. Gave them small pieces of ribbon, and sent them forward to the village.
1. Confirm that this is an actual entry from the well-known published journals. The paper and ink, applied it seems with a quill, appear appropriate to the period. This is either a remarkable facsimile of William Clark's actual handwriting from his original journals, or the original itself. Have contacted the National Archives and am awaiting verification on that point. T.P.
A man came out to meet me with great caution and conducted me to a large, spacious lodge, which he told me by signs was the lodge of his great chief, who had set out 3 days previous with all the warriors of the nation to war, and would return in 15 to 18 days. The few men that were left in the village, and a great number of women, gathered around me with much apparent fear, and appeared pleased. They were a stout, handsome, well-dressed band.
2. This passage describes Clark's first meeting with the tribe known later to us as the Nez Perce, or Pierced Noses, who were a significant presence in this part of the territory. This name was given to them by early French trappers after the tribe's affinity for jewelry and other adornments affixed through the nose. This encounter occurred soon after the expedition passed into the eastern reaches of what is now Washington State and not far south of the present-day location of Twin Peaks. The following day, these same men led Clark to meet another chief whose camp was farther downriver. This chief was called Twisted Hair. T.P.
21 September, 1805. With great cheerfulness, Twisted Hair drew me a kind of chart of the river on a white elk skin. He said that the river forked a long distance above and passed through the mountains, at which place was a great fall of water, passing through the rocks. I did not reckon precise what this place would signify, but one Shoshone guide thinks it regards something like the peculiar fascination with spirits we find among Indians of this region. I sent one man back, Reuben Fields, with an Indian to meet Captain Lewis and direct him to meet us here at this camp.
1. I have now heard from an expert who positively verified this section as William Clark's handwriting and a known part of the historically published journals. The two commanders of the expedition had indeed split their party to hunt for provisions a few days earlier. T.P.
3. Excerpt from a letter written by Meriwether Lewis to President Thomas Jefferson, dated September 25th, 1805.
After receiving from R. Fields, I pushed my party forward to meet Captain Clark at the village of Twisted Hair. We spent the next several days gathering provisions and resting at the camp of Twisted Hair. The first night I questioned him about the map he had drawn for Captain Clark of the falls and mountains to the north. He said that near those falls, white people lived from whom he had procured three strange artifacts that he showed me. No one in our party recognized them or could divine their purpose or utility, save one. The chief removed this ring from a small leather bag strung on a rawhide strip that he retrieved from his lodge. Although his people wear many adornments of sophisticated design, this one appears to be of more advanced craftsmanship than any artifacts we've seen of native manufacture. The ring and setting have been expertly fashioned from precious metal or a bronze alloy, work you would only expect to find from a master smith. As to the white people from whom it was allegedly obtained, it has to date been our belief that no Americans or Europeans have preceded us into this part of the territory. It was also Captain Clark's prior understanding from the chief that we were the first white Americans they had encountered. This seems an assumption that we will now have to re-examine. Perhaps the chief is simply telling a tall tale, and the ring was obtained through trade or barter from a French trapper moving through the area. Twisted Hair became agitated when I pressed him for more information on this matter. He pointed to the symbol on the ring, turned it upside down, and said something that our Shoshone guide couldn't fully translate about an owl, which one could say the symbol, viewed from that angle, vaguely resembles. That was all he would put forth on the matter. Our guide soon afterward told me in confidence that the chief had said the ring was related in some way to the spirit world they worship here. The spirit world is part of their pagan belief system, and from all I've gleaned to date bears no relation to our Christian God. For instance, as I understand it, they might see an animal like an owl as in some way divine. It was my belief that not only the chief seemed to be withholding deeper information from us, as neither he nor my guide would elaborate. Mr. President, I believe this subject may be pertinent to the matter you and I discussed privately prior to my departure.
1. This entire letter remains problematic. I can find no record of it in the original LNC journals or any mention of it among the voluminous correspondence penned by Lewis to President Jefferson. Prior to the expedition, Lewis had served as Jefferson's secretary for 2 years, lived in the White House, and during that time became one of his most trusted confidants. Jefferson's father was a business associate of Lewis's grandfather, and the president had known Lewis since he was a boy, growing up not far from Jefferson's Virginia estate. Because Lewis had experienced extensive contact with Native Americans during his youth, enjoyed cordial relations, and often championed their cause, Jefferson personally chose Lewis to lead the Corps of Discovery. Lewis then selected, as his co-commander, his former commanding officer, the more experienced military man and explorer, William Clark. Jefferson's selection of Lewis was kept secret, as was the expedition itself. The Louisiana Purchase had not yet been completed during these planning stages, and the Corps of Discovery would be heading into hostile territory that three European powers, the French, Spanish, and English, had all targeted for their own expansionist colonial ambitions. The expedition would be fraught with danger from start to finish, security was paramount, and time was of the essence. Lewis's cryptic reference to a private conversation with Jefferson bears deeper investigation. He does elaborate somewhat during the following passage. T.P.
It is my intention to venture north with our guide and a select group of men to find and explore the area detailed on the map drawn by Twisted Hair. Captain Clark will remain here with the remainder of our party, and they will spend their time constructing canoes, employing a new method shown to us by the chief and his men. The chief has given me the ring mentioned above to take along, but with emphatic gesture indicated it should be left in its pouch and under no circumstances worn. Your sincere and obedient servant, Meriwether Lewis.
2. On the face of it, it would seem this letter bears all the earmarks of an elaborate hoax. And yet, analysis does confirm this as the handwriting of Lewis to an almost certain probability. As this is one of the few original documents in the dossier, I have submitted it for independent carbon dating and chemical testing of both the paper and ink to see if it is, in fact, appropriate to the stated time frame of the early 19th century. No mention is made of any side trip made by Lewis during this time frame in his published journals. However, the next entry in the official journals, authored by either Lewis or Clark, does not appear for 6 more days. It has always been the opinion of Lewis scholars that this period of time was used for the construction of the canoes and for rest and recovery, as many of the expedition had by this time fallen ill with intestinal disorders related to malaria. T.P.
4. Excerpt from a journal found in the private papers of President Thomas Jefferson. Undated. Late 1805.
1. Let it be stated up front that there is no copy or record of this letter among the official presidential papers, but once again, handwriting analysis and chemical testing of paper and ink suggest it is the work of Thomas Jefferson. My attempt to track this letter led me to a cache of assorted and supposedly lost writings, a collection of unbound manuscripts discovered in the archives at Monticello in 1870 by the president's oldest living son, Thomas Randolph Jefferson. This cache was transferred to the care of the State Department at around that time in a box labeled Private, Unexamined. I've accessed this collection. In the 1940s, it was moved to a section of the Library of Congress that requires maximum security clearance, and was frankly astonished. Many of these writings have never been made public, as they contain the president's musings on a number of strange, disparate, and esoteric subjects, among them the role of Freemasonry in the lives of the Founding Fathers, the real and present danger to the young republic and masonry itself of Adam Weishaupt's Bavarian Illuminati, a perennial paranoid conspiracy bogeyman, and Jefferson's fascination with supernatural elements of Native American mythology. Jefferson and Lewis were both high-ranking Freemasons of long-standing members of a fraternal organization that emerged in the 15th century. Its original purpose seems to have been regulatory, setting qualifying professional standards for stonemasons while serving as an intermediary for them with clients or authorities, much like a modern guild or union. Over the centuries, Freemasonry evolved into a worldwide fraternal body and expanded its membership far beyond craftsmen into statecraft, and even the foundation of governments, including America's own, taking on an air of secrecy and even mysticism. Its closely guarded rituals and symbolism make it one of the longest-standing secret societies in known history. While preparing for the expedition at the direction of the president, Lewis had spent extensive time studying at the Library of the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, founded by Benjamin Franklin, a high-ranking Mason himself. Lewis spent weeks there studying various physical sciences he would use on the expedition, and who knows what else. The society at this time was rumored to also have collected the largest and most extensive library of ancient esoteric literature in North America, dating back centuries on such occult subjects as alchemy and transmutation. But in none of the aforementioned archives, either public or private, did I find any other copy of the entry shown here, which leaves the intriguing possibility that the copy in this dossier may be a previously undiscovered original. T.P.
No news from Lewis for a number of weeks, as his dispatches since April make their way back towards civilization, at the merciless vagaries of various and irregular riverboat traffic, then onward and east by stage from St. Louis. And then among the packet I received today, this. What to make of it? One can only assume it bears some relation to this. In addition to the Corps of Discovery's explicit and publicly stated mission, under confidential instruction from me, L was to remain alert to the chance to explore any opportunity which might provide insight into the spiritual or shamanistic traditions of the northwestern tribal people he would encounter. This instruction arose in part from our mutual study of certain volumes in the possession of the APS library that suggested anomalous and peculiar geological arcana might be encountered once one traveled farther west beyond the border of the Louisiana Territory into the uncharted lands of Oregon Country. In this instance, L appears to have exceeded the letter of this secondary objective to an alarming degree. Having read his dispatch a half dozen times this morning, I remain firmly convinced this must have been composed while in the grip of fever, perhaps even after partaking of some herbal or vegetative compound, either accidentally or one given to him by some unidentified natives he encountered. How else to explain these rambling and often incoherent ravings? It begins with a more or less direct account of traveling 3 days due north from the main body of the Corps to a certain location that Lewis says was revealed to him on a recently drawn native map, at which point I am then treated to a disjointed assortment of passages that defy categorization, i.e., lights from the sky, the silvery spheres, music like some heavenly choir, fire that burns but does not consume, colors unseen or unimagined flowing from all things, gold, all gold, bright and shining, all of it written in a rapid scrawl, many of the words illegible, nearly a page of lunatic ranting about the secret deep within the color red, puzzling reference to classical natuary, black lines, and a thoroughly incoherent discourse on the mysterious force B. Franklin had stumbled upon. Finally, the fragmented and feverish mention of an uncanny encounter with a silent man. His last words in this vein, at which point L appears to have altered course and sailed back toward reason. I should have heeded his warning. He goes on to write that he has destroyed the native map and all of the record of his passage north. Which warning, I wonder, and whose? The Indian chief Twisted Hair or the silent man?
2. An update appears on an adjoining page and, if taken at the president's word, was written approximately 1 year after the previous entry. T.P.
In the next dispatch I received from him, not for many months later, one hastens to add, L. writes, reunited with Clark October 3rd. All our men getting better in health and at work at the canoes. We will soon press on westward. I have made no mention of what I have experienced above the falls. No one else who accompanied me appears to recollect any part of it. At times it nearly slips from my memory, like a silvery glimpse of fish in a river. I could have returned it to the chief, but I have decided for now to keep it.
3. Does it refer to the ring described and drawn by Lewis in his earlier post? T.P.
I am not at all certain what he refers to as it here, but it otherwise appears as if L at this point is once again back within the confines of his sound mind, a result I was heartened to have confirmed by the subsequent dispatches I have just received from him nearly 1 year afterwards. Whatever might have occurred during L's diversion, after months of strenuous but often inconclusive wayfaring, within days of his return, the expedition resumed their journey to the west with unnerving certainty. In a matter of days, they made swift and certain passage onto the Columbia River and within weeks found their way to the Pacific Ocean. Now, nearly 2.5 years after departure, they have arrived safely back in St. Louis.
Archivist's note. The principals of the Corps of Discovery returned to Washington in 1807, where Lewis and Clark were greeted as heroes. The vast collection of plant and animal specimens they brought back with them kept scientists engaged for years. Their celestial and geographical observations filled in the map of what would soon become the western United States. The expedition was judged a spectacular success. As an immediate reward for his years of service, in 1807 Jefferson appointed Lewis as governor of the Upper Louisiana Territory, a position he returned to St. Louis to fill. Two troubling and difficult years followed. Two sharply divergent narratives emerged from this period. Either Lewis began a steep descent into alcoholism and incipient madness, or he became the target of an elaborate and effective plot by powerful enemies already entrenched in the developing Western territories to undermine his position.
4. Two additional entries in the dossier pertaining to Lewis's time in that office follow. T.P.
5. The Missouri Gazette, September 21, 1808.
It has been announced that on this date a charter has been granted for the founding of the first St. Louis Masonic Lodge, Lodge 111. Meriwether Lewis, famous explorer and current governor of the Upper Louisiana Territory, is noted on the charter as its first master.
This appeared on the bottom of the third page of the paper as a minor news item. Not long afterward, Lewis initiated William Clark into the St. Louis Lodge. Clark later founded Missouri Lodge 12 and remained active in Masonic circles during the remainder of his life. Jefferson may have initiated Lewis into the secretive fraternal order personally.
1. Theories about the arcane influence of the Masons on the early development of the American government abound. For instance, it's often suggested that the design for the country's great seal, the pyramid and eye symbol that appears on the $1 bill, was passed to Jefferson one dark night by a mysterious hooded figure who just as quickly vanished. Almost a third of our presidents have been Masons. As I've discovered, one could fill a library with books written on the subject. T.P.
These theories suggest that there were two esoteric organizations vying for future control of the developing nation. One with positive democratic intentions for its citizens, Freemasons, and the other malign, the Bavarian Illuminati, interested only in enriching its elite class at the expense of the general populace. Opposing ideologies, it might well be said, which continue that struggle to this day. It should also be noted that Lewis financed and organized the publication of the Gazette, the territory's first newspaper, soon after his arrival, bringing a civilizing influence to a rough frontier colony that at the time of his arrival numbered no more than 300 people, which suggests he may well have written the article shown here personally.
2. What significance the creator of the dossier ascribes to the two men's participation in Freemasonry is difficult to yet fully ascertain, but may be hinted at by the following entry. T.P.
I have occasionally underlined passages that seem to me pertinent to consistent thematic details. 6. Findings of an inquiry conducted into the death of Meriwether Lewis, 1989.
1. No official headings identify who conducted this inquiry close to 200 years after the incident. The archivist emerges as the most likely candidate. T.P.
On the evening of October 10, 1809, arriving alone on horseback, Meriwether Lewis took shelter for the night at an inn along the Natchez Trace, a primitive trail carved through the Tennessee wilderness, 70 miles southwest of Nashville. Still the governor of the Upper Louisiana Territory, Lewis had left St. Louis and was en route to Washington, D.C. for two purposes. The first was to personally protest and, he hoped, overturn State Department denials of various reasonable expenses spent out of pocket in the discharge of his office, leaving his financial affairs in a precarious state.
2. This was a common complaint of appointed officials serving in the Western territories. The fledgling U.S. government was perpetually short of funds at this time, and the new capital's bureaucrats were notoriously slow to make reimbursements. T.P.
Lewis planned to attack this predicament directly. He had finally organized all of his and Clark's journals from the expedition of discovery. He was on his way to deliver them to a Philadelphia publisher and collect delivery money promised by a contract arranged prior to his departing for St. Louis to assume his job as governor. His second and more secret purpose, according to recently uncovered sources, was to deliver to Jefferson and his newly elected successor, President James Madison, evidence of a conspiracy of corruption and usurpation being waged by the young country's political enemies in the Louisiana Territory.
3. This references a traitorous plot conducted by Jefferson's disgraced former Vice President Aaron Burr, who had fled west after killing former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton in a notorious duel on the New Jersey Palisades, and various co-conspirators, which was exposed in 1805. This faction planned to seize control of a large area in Texas, Mexico, and Louisiana in order to create a new and separate republic to be ruled by Burr as feudal monarch. General James Wilkinson, commander-in-chief of the country's armed forces, before presidents regularly assumed that title, and Lewis's predecessor as governor of the Upper Louisiana Territories, had written to Jefferson, warning him of the plot, which resulted in Burr's arrest and trial for treason in 1807. T.P.
This correspondent now believes that while serving in St. Louis, Governor Lewis discovered that General James Wilkinson, who had exposed Burr's plot to Jefferson, had in fact been a principal in this traitorous cabal and exposed Burr's treachery only to save himself. Wilkinson, the commanding general of the United States Army, had for decades been working as a double agent for the Spanish crown, during which time he ruthlessly destroyed the careers of multiple rivals through the use of forged poison pen letters, slander, secret ciphers, and other means. None of this would come to light until Wilkinson's death in 1825. He had also previously attempted to murder Meriwether Lewis. Wilkinson had betrayed Jefferson's confidence by revealing to his Spanish handlers the Corps of Discovery's secret expedition. While Lewis and Clark were in the field, Spain ordered Wilkinson to stop them by any means necessary. 3 different times, companies of Spanish assassins, over 200 in number, ventured north after the Corps of Discovery, once missing them near the Platte River by less than 2 days. If these men had succeeded in finding them, the subsequent history of the United States would have been drastically altered.
4. I can verify this charge has been substantiated. A Revolutionary War hero who served as commander-in-chief under 3 presidents, Wilkinson is now described by historians as the most consummate artist in treason the nation ever produced. Along with Burr and Benedict Arnold, both of whom Wilkinson knew well, conspired with, and got the better of, they represent a triumvirate of treachery and deceit unsurpassed in the next 200 years. All of these men are also invariably associated with the Illuminati strain of conspiracy. T.P.
Lewis left St. Louis carrying extensive evidence he'd uncovered of Wilkinson's past and present treachery, which he intended to deliver to Jefferson and Madison. Lewis had originally planned to travel downriver to New Orleans and from there by boat to Washington. So concerned was he about his real intent being discovered by Wilkinson, then commanding officer of corrupt New Orleans, that Lewis abandoned his route to Washington mid-journey, left the river at Fort Pickering, near present-day Memphis, and set off on horseback into the wilds. Lewis wrote a letter to President Madison from Fort Pickering to explain his change in plan. My fear of original papers relative to my time in office falling into the hands of our enemies induced me to change my route and proceed by land through the state of Tennessee to Washington.
5. Verified. This letter exists. T.P.
The man who accompanied Lewis from Fort Pickering as his guide and protector until Nashville was Major James Neely. Neely had recently been named agent in charge of relations with the Choctaw Indian Nation in western Tennessee. A recent posting that had been made, unbeknownst to Lewis, by none other than General James Wilkinson. Lewis's last night. On the evening of October 10, 1809, Meriwether Lewis arrived alone at the log cabin lodging known as Grinder's Stand, the home of John Grinder, who was away on business. His wife, Priscilla Grinder, admitted Lewis. His servants, whom Lewis had sent out to recover pack animals that had run off earlier that day, arrived later. Mrs. Grinder noticed Lewis was armed with 2 pistols, a rifle, a long knife, and a hatchet worn in his belt. While eating little of the dinner Mrs. Grinder prepared, Lewis appeared agitated. After the meal, according to Grinder, he paced back and forth in front of the cabin, smoking a pipe and talking to himself. Mrs. Grinder described him as talking like a lawyer and ranting about his enemies. She also saw him continually worrying a small leather pouch he kept around his neck on a rawhide loop. This went on past dark. When Lewis stepped inside, he appeared lucid and spoke kindly to her. But when she prepared a bed for him, Lewis refused to sleep on it and instead made a pallet against the wall facing the front door with a buffalo robe, his pistols at his side. After setting up Lewis's servants in the barn, Mrs. Grinder went to bed with her children in an adjoining cabin. She was awoken at 3 a.m. by a sound of a struggle from next door, heavy objects falling to the floor, cries, then a gunshot, followed by another. She heard Lewis shout, "Oh, Lord," but claimed she was too terrified to come to his aid, when he then called to her for help and water. She also claimed she saw him through the cracks in the cabin wall, staggering around outside in the moonlight. Mrs. Grinder roused his servants at first light, and they found Lewis still alive, lying in a pool of his own blood. He'd suffered 2 gunshot wounds, to the back of the head and the abdomen, and his throat and arms had been slashed with a knife or razor. Mrs. Grinder claimed that Lewis begged them to use his rifle to finish him off, before falling quiet and dying shortly afterward. The Indian agent who'd served as his escort, Major James Neely, arrived at the inn before noon that morning. He identified himself to Grinder as an associate who had been traveling with Lewis since Fort Pickering, but had stayed behind the day before, at Lewis's insistence, to search for 2 horses that had strayed into the woods. Why he arrived a full 12 hours after Lewis's servants, who'd been charged with the same task, was not asked or answered. Making no effort to alert local authorities, Neely surveyed the scene, claimed all of Lewis's possessions, and supervised his burial in a hastily built coffin on the property nearby. A few days later, Neely wrote this to Thomas Jefferson and posted it from Nashville.
6. Verified. T.P.
Nashville, Tennessee, 18th October, 1809. Sir, it is with extreme pain that I have to inform you of the death of His Excellency, Meriwether Lewis, Governor of Upper Louisiana, who died on the morning of the 11th, and I am sorry to say, by suicide. Major James Neely.
Jefferson published a public statement in response, which accepted Neely's tragic version of events without questioning. As a result, suicide was quickly then and has ever since been assumed as the cause of Lewis's death. Jefferson's opinion was based exclusively on Neely's account of the testimony given him by Mrs. Grinder, the sole witness to the tragedy, and later, on one other. The Russell Letters. Jefferson's opinion of Lewis's troubled state was reinforced by only one source. A letter unavailable to the public for almost 200 years, describing Lewis's journey from St. Louis to Nashville. The letter was written to Jefferson and signed by the commander at Fort Pickering, Lewis's friend, Major Gilbert Russell, and dated 2 years after Lewis's death. According to this letter, Lewis had arrived at the fort from St. Louis in a state of mental derangement, brought on by despair about his economic troubles and compounded by bouts of heavy drinking. Russell states that the ship's captain told him Lewis had attempted suicide 2 times between St. Louis and Fort Pickering. Lewis had attempted to take his life yet again since his arrival, so Major Russell had seen fit to incarcerate him until he was completely in his senses, at which point the letter concludes with Lewis, having regained his equilibrium, departing for Nashville with Major Neely. The tone and style of this letter is completely at odds with an earlier letter written by Russell and received by Jefferson in the weeks after Lewis's death. This earlier letter makes no mention of suicide attempts or derangement, and instead paints a warm portrait of Lewis consistent with everything known about him, saying that in the weeks before his death he appeared thoughtful, strong-minded, and purposeful. Near the end of this letter, Russell refers to Lewis's death as a murder. The first letter Jefferson received has been thoroughly authenticated as being written in Russell's hand.
7. Verified. T.P.
A grand jury investigation into the death of Governor Lewis, conducted recently by the state of Tennessee, conclusively determined that the second Russell letter, discovered 2 centuries afterward, is a forgery. Not only was the second letter forged, but this damning document came directly from the office of General James Wilkinson. Handwriting analysts found an exact match to the hand of Wilkinson's clerk, who wrote all his correspondence. The forged letter was not only sent to Jefferson, a copy was made and placed in Wilkinson's files, a common practice in the days before automated copying. That's where it remained until its recent discovery.
8. Confirmed. TP.
So why was this second letter sent over 2 years after Lewis's death? There's a cold-blooded logic to it. It was written while Wilkinson was being court-martialed for treason over his own role in the Burr conspiracy, a charge ultimately dismissed for lack of evidence. While Wilkinson escaped conviction on this and two other treason charges during his lifetime, it finally came to light after his death in 1825 that he had been serving as a double agent for Spain since 1787. So, a reasonable conclusion. After being charged with treason, Wilkinson forged this letter to falsely establish that during his journey, Lewis was in a suicidal state of mind, in case Wilkinson should ever be questioned about what role he might have played in his tragic death.
9. This sounds reasonable to me as well. I'm embarrassed to confess I didn't know any of these details about Lewis or Wilkinson, and I was a history major. T.P.
Lewis's possessions. Major Neely and the trunks holding Lewis's possessions reached Nashville a week after his death. The trunks were sent on to Monticello, where they arrived at the end of November. A man named Thomas Freeman, operating under the orders of his longtime superior officer, General James Wilkinson, conveyed them to Jefferson's estate. Only one inventory of Lewis's possessions survives, one taken by Jefferson's secretary, Isaac Coles, after they reached Monticello. Coles' list makes no mention of the $220 with which Lewis was known to have left Fort Pickering, nor does it include any mention of Lewis's pistols, hunting knife, two horses, or gold watch. Major James Neely kept Lewis's best horse after his death and was seen in public wearing Lewis's knife and pistols on his belt, as well as his gold watch. May we presume he also kept the cash? Affirmative. This somehow made the local papers and was brought to the attention of Lewis's family. Shortly afterward, Neely was confronted by Lewis's brother-in-law, who requested the return of these personal items. He secured only the horse before Neely slipped from sight and from history. Also missing from the inventory, a substantial percentage of Lewis's papers, which Coles described as having been thoroughly rifled through. This includes the evidence of Wilkinson's corruption in Louisiana that Lewis referenced in his letter to Madison, along with many of his journals from the Expedition of Discovery. It is firmly established fact that Lewis left Fort Pickering with these writings in his possession. Also missing was a sophisticated cipher device of Jefferson's own design that Lewis had used for years to encode messages he sent to Jefferson.
10. Verified. TP.
Most of the papers that went missing have never been recovered. When the definitive edition of Lewis and Clark's journals was published, no mention or explanation was offered about the peculiar absence, covering more than half of their 2-year mission, of so many entries written by the man of letters in charge of the mission.
11. The definitive accounts of the Lewis and Clark expedition were published in 1814. According to numerous scholars, many of the private diaries Lewis was known to have written during the expedition have never been recovered. T.P.
Also listed in the inventory, small leather pouch found hung around the governor's neck. Empty.
12. This seems to describe the pouch that earlier may have held the jade ring, so it seems likely that Neely stole the ring as well. T.P.
Last among the possessions that were inventoried remains the most curious. Found stuffed in the pocket of his coat, the Masonic apron of the governor, bloodstained. A word of explanation. A version of this ceremonial garment is given, upon entry, to every initiate accepted into the Masonic order. A symbolic version of a craftsman tool belt, or in the parlance of the day, an apron. This object is worn during all Masonic meetings and rituals and is supposed to remain in the possession of the initiate at all times. Made from silk, backed with linen, and hand-painted with the order's arcane symbols, including the all-seeing eye, which also adorns the $1 bill. This highly personal object was returned by Jefferson, a fellow Mason, to Lewis's mother. It was passed down through three generations of descendants before being given to the Masonic Grand Lodge in Helena, Montana, where it remains on display to this day. Its provenance is unshakable.
13. Verified. TP.
With the permission of the lodge, this correspondent was able to gain possession of the apron in order to perform a complete examination. Tests conducted on the bloodstains still visible on the garment yielded the following results. DNA testing confirms, through detailed comparison with samples from living relatives, that the blood on the apron is not that of Meriwether Lewis. The blood on the garment belongs to two other individuals, unidentified. Is it possible that after murdering him, his assailants wiped their own blood on this garment, sacred to Lewis as a Mason, as an act of desecration? Did this act betray some underlying antipathy to the organization that hints at their identity or motive? Official inquiries into Lewis's death. Although no documents of the proceedings survive, a local Tennessee County inquest into the matter was conducted after Lewis's death. Surviving oral histories from county residents claim that a charge of murder against the Grinders and parties unknown was returned but then dropped for reasons attributed to the jury's fear of retribution.
14. Confirmed. TP.
Shortly afterward, the Grinders disappear from Tennessee, after, it is said, having come back into a substantial sum of money. In conclusion, at the time of his death, Meriwether Lewis was 35 years old, a strong, sturdy individual, toughened by years in the military and the wilderness. He had survived deprivations unimaginable by modern men. During the expedition, he defended himself and his men courageously in battle with hostiles, in one instance, killing four attackers single-handedly. He performed one of the more remarkable services ever rendered to his nation, and his personal friend and patron, Thomas Jefferson, in our history. You would need to combine Charles Lindbergh, John Glenn, and Neil Armstrong to conjure a 20th-century figure with a comparable impact on the national psyche. Proving himself an able political leader during his time as governor, Lewis might one day have succeeded his mentor as president, a job for which many believe Jefferson was grooming him. One has to look ahead to the assassinations of Lincoln and Kennedy to find a more shocking loss of such a universally admired public figure. Under confidential orders from the president, Lewis traversed an untamed wilderness and returned triumphant. Based on my recent findings, it is reasonable that Jefferson sent Lewis not only to find a Northwest Passage to the Pacific, history's standard narrative, but to investigate many strange rumors and claims stemming from this region, an unknown tribe of white Indians, the existence of fabulous gold and silver mines, the possible existence of mastodons, sea monsters, and other quasi-mythical beasts, as well as traces of ancient, vanished civilizations, including a mysterious race of giants.
15. I can verify that there are dozens of 19th and early 20th century newspaper stories from across the country detailing the recovery of various giant skeletons, usually 7 to 9 feet tall, most often from ancient burial mounds. These are believed to predate any previously known North American civilization. And curiously, in most instances, the bones were apparently collected by the Smithsonian Institution and never seen again. TP.
On at least one occasion, referenced earlier, it seems Lewis encountered mysteries peculiar to this corner of the world, the Upper Northwest. Mysteries that, this correspondent can personally confirm, persist to this day.
16. From which we conclude, as we build a profile for him, that the archivist has personal knowledge of the region. TP.
With all humility, by the authority vested in me by my own confidential charter, this correspondent has endeavored to carry on the work begun by Captain Lewis. The spirit of fearless inquiry into enduring mysteries applied in the search for ancient truths that transcend and defy conventional wisdom. This dossier represents the fruits of that labor.
17. Another crucial glimpse into the mind of the archivist, Determining this person's identity remains priority number one, TP.
As to the governor's suicide, based solely on slanderous accounts offered by political enemies, this notion became, by default, the prevailing narrative of Lewis's tragic end. Mental illness was so poorly comprehended in his time that a more shameful fate for a hero of his stature is impossible to imagine. This shocking notion cast such a pall over his reputation that it nearly obliterated inquiry. But not quite. A U.S. congressional committee ordered an investigation into the matter in 1848. They also voted to erect a monument over his grave, which stands there to this day. Prior to placing the monument, his coffin was recovered, identified, and briefly opened. A doctor engaged by the committee viewed the body, at that point still remarkably well-preserved, and testified in the official report that Governor Lewis almost certainly died at the hands of an assassin. As scientific techniques improved in the 20th century, Lewis's descendants have pressed the government to exhume his remains for comprehensive forensic study, which may well reverse the 200-year-old calumny his reputation has suffered. Two last telling details from that congressional inquiry. Mrs. Grinder testified that she witnessed Lewis crawling outside, begging for water, in the moonlight. I have examined records of the phases of the moon for that year. There was no moon that night. Also, the carpenter who fashioned the crude coffin in which Lewis was hastily buried later told the committee that he had viewed the body and testified that he saw a wound in the rear of Lewis's skull.
18. Both verified. TP.
Which raises this question. Governor Lewis was renowned as one of the great marksmen of his era. So are we to believe that while attempting suicide, he would shoot himself in the back of the head and fail? That he then shot himself in the chest and again failed to finish the job, leading to several final hours of almost incomprehensible suffering? It seems far more likely that Lewis had a good reason to fear pursuit, as his behavior suggests. When he arrived at Grinder's stand, it seems equally likely he suffered an assault at the hands of unknown assailants that night, suffering grievous and fatal injuries. The slashes to his throat and arms sound like what forensic science would classically describe as defensive wounds.
19. Agreed. TP.
Given that the blood of two unknown men was found on his Masonic apron, it appears Lewis fought to defend himself against multiple attackers with every last fiber of strength in him. Final questions. What motivated General Wilkinson and the Spanish to pursue the extermination of the Corps of Discovery? What were they so afraid of Lewis and Clark finding in the Pacific Northwest? Did Lewis write about some darker secret in his missing journals? Was there something besides incriminating evidence he was conveying to Washington that inspired assassins to track him down in the wilderness, brutally murder him, then frame his death as suicide to deflect inquiry?
20. To which I would add, what happened to the ring in Lewis's pouch after Neely apparently took it? And what happened to Neely himself, who vanished for good a few months afterward? Why did Twisted Hair warn Lewis about not putting on the ring? The section concerning Meriwether Lewis left me determined to know more. I can report that at the urging of Lewis's living descendants, a grand jury was finally convened by the state of Tennessee in 1996, presumably after the dossier was compiled. After hearing expert testimony from 24 witnesses in forensic, ballistic, and criminal investigation disciplines, the jury returned a finding that the remains of Governor Lewis should be exhumed and examined for the purpose of identifying the exact cause of death. After initially denying this request, the National Park Service reversed its ruling in 2008 and recommended the exhumation proceed. In 2010, the Park Service reversed itself again and declined the grand jury's order to retrieve the remains. The only explanation they offered was that it would cause untold damage to a cherished historic monument. What such an examination could do to help restore the reputation of the man this monument was erected to honor goes unremarked upon. So 2 centuries after his death, the body of Meriwether Lewis, national hero, lies moldering in the grave, just off the ancient road known as the Natchez Trace. A seldom-visited site in a still-remote stretch of American wilderness, a more melancholy tribute would be hard to imagine. T.P.
Archivist's final thought. I have recently verified one last curious aspect of this story. When Jefferson sent Lewis to the Northwest, he ordered him to keep an eye out for various strange phenomena often mentioned in rumors of the region. Among them, a tribe of white Indians and a race of giants. I have found dozens of strange references in the 19th century American press to the recovery of skeletons of men in burial mounds that are between 7 and 9 feet tall. For instance, just one of many.
Wisconsin mound opened. Skeleton found of a man over 9 feet high with an enormous skull. Maple Creek, Wisconsin, December 19th. One of the three recently discovered mounds in this town has been opened. In it was found the skeleton of a man of gigantic size. The bones measured from head to foot over 9 feet and were in a fair state of preservation. The skull was as large as a half bushel measure. Some finely tempered rods of copper and other relics were lying near the bones. The mound from which these relics were taken is 10 feet high and 30 feet long, and varies from 6 to 8 feet in width. The two mounds of lesser size will be excavated soon.
There is also no dispute that when Lewis and Clark returned east, they brought with them a chief of the Mandan tribe from the Dakotas named Shehekeshote, a.k.a. Big White. The Mandan are often mentioned in connection with a pervasive rumor from the early expansionist era that somewhere in the upper Midwest dwelt a tribe of Welsh-speaking white Indians, alleged descendants of a 12th-century Welsh prince called Madoc. In Welsh, Madog Ab Owain Gwynedd, who sailed to America and followed the Mississippi north, founding a series of colonies along the way. Evidence for this is offered in the house-like structures in which the Mandan lived, which looked like early Welsh villages, and the unusual boats they used, which closely resembled the Welsh seagoing coracle. This much is fact. Chief Shehekeshote was very pale-complected, with blue or green eyes, and he stood at least 6 feet 10 inches tall. Sheheke and his wife and son traveled with Lewis and Clark all the way to Washington, D.C., where Lewis introduced him to Thomas Jefferson. After an absence of 2 years and 2 attempts to return him to his people that required an army escort of more than 600 soldiers through hostile territory, Sheheke finally made it back to his Mandan village. Sadly, it is said that his people did not believe the chief's stories of this powerful new civilization and its leaders that he had encountered. As a result, Sheheke lost his standing with his nation, and, a shattered man, died in a Sioux raid a few years later.
21. All verified and, I must concur, very, very strange indeed. The dossier continues on the following page, signifying the start of a new section. T.P.
Nez Perce History. 1. The story of Chief Inmutuyalatlat, Chief Joseph, of the Nez Perce. In the 1870s, white prospectors discovered gold in the Wallawa Valley in the Pacific Northwest, now central Washington State, the traditional homeland of the Nez Perce, the people first encountered by Meriwether Lewis. Soon afterward, claiming that the U.S. government had already acquired the rights to their valley in a treaty with another tribe, General Oliver Howard was dispatched with a full brigade to escort the Nez Perce to a reservation. This was a direct violation of the government's existing treaty with the Nez Perce.
1. I can verify that the following is the statement made by Chief Joseph in direct response to Howard's demand that he must abandon his land and lead his people onto a reservation. T.P.
Perhaps you think that the Great Spirit Chief sent you here to dispose of us as you see fit. If I thought you were sent here by the Great Spirit Chief, I might be induced to think that you had the right to dispose of me. Do not misunderstand me, but understand fully with reference to my people's affection for this land. I never said this land was mine to do with as I choose. The only one who has the right to dispose of it is the one who created it. I simply claim a right to live on my land and accord you the privilege to return to yours. In treaty councils, the commissioners have claimed that our country had been sold by another to your government. Suppose a white man should come to me and say, "Joseph, I like your horses and I want to buy them." I say no to him, "No, my horses suit me, I will not sell them." Then he goes to my neighbor and says to him, "Joseph has some good horses and I want to buy them," but he refuses to sell. My neighbor answers, "Pay me the money and I will sell you Joseph's horses." The white man returns to me and says, "Joseph, I have bought your horses and you must let me have them." If we sold our lands to the government, this is the way they were bought.
2. Verified. TP.
The Nez Perce had never before been a hostile tribe toward American settlers. After Joseph's refusal, in spite of his efforts to keep the peace, hostilities escalated and the cavalry were mobilized to finish the job. To avoid being slaughtered where they lived or forced onto a reservation, Chief Joseph led his people, a group of over 700 men, women, and children, including only 200 fighting men, on a desperate flight toward Canada. 2. Chief Joseph's speech to his people before the retreat, summer 1877.
"I have tried to save you from suffering and sorrow. We are few and they are many. You can see all that we have at a glance. They have goods and ammunition in abundance. We must suffer great hardship and loss. I will go now to the place known to our ancestors, seldom visited, the place of smoke by the Great Falls and the Twin Mountains, to seek aid of the Great Spirit Chief in this time of need."
1. This sounds similar to the place visited by Lewis and Chief Twisted Hair, an ancestor of Joseph's. TP.
This sounds like a reference to one of their principal myths, common to many nations in the Northwest region, that refer to ancient relationships with mysterious beings they refer to as Sky People. Chief Joseph had never before been called to serve his people as a military leader. His role was closer to that of a spiritual leader or elder. Despite this lack of military experience when he returned from this mysterious pilgrimage, Chief Joseph led his people on one of the great tactical retreats in history, during which they engaged in a series of 13 battles or skirmishes against more than 2,000 soldiers, cavalry, and artillery under the command of General Howard. 3. Dispatch from General Oliver Howard to Colonel Nelson Miles at Fort Keogh, August 1877.
"Joseph and his band have eluded our troops, and he is now continuing his retreat toward British Columbia. I shall never forget the actual pass through which he made his exit to Clark Basin, near Heart Mountain. He seemed to travel through the mountain itself, by way of the dry bed of what was usually a mountain torrent, with such precipitous walls on either side that it was like going through a gigantic rough railroad tunnel. According to my scouts, there had been water running through that channel just days before. I had troops stationed at Heart Mountain in accordance with instructions, ready and watching for them. But at daybreak, a giant cloud of dust or smoke appeared to the east. My men rode in pursuit, believing that Joseph's whole body had got past him, and following this long dust trail, abandoning the mouth of the pass. Once they passed on, Joseph led his people out of the tunnel through the mountain. By the time we reached that spot a day later, a river once again flowed through that channel. We believe he is aiming at refuge with Sitting Bull. He is traveling with women and children and wounded at the rate of 25 miles a day, but he regulates his gait by ours. We will lessen our speed to about 12 miles a day, and he will also slow down. Please at once take a diagonal line to head him off with all the force at your command, and when you have intercepted him, send word to me immediately, and I will, by forced march, unite with you."
1. Verified. TP.
4. The Turning Point. According to Colonel Miles, the commander who cut off Joseph's retreat.
"At a desperate point in our pursuit, our forces encountered a mountain man, a familiar figure who had lived for decades in these parts, named Liver-Eating Johnson. Johnson, who claimed to have knowledge of Indian ways and what he called the source of Joseph's power,
led us a roundabout way in forced march to a position in the Bear Paws that put us in position to cut off the line of Joseph's northerly retreat.
After 11 weeks, having never lost a battle against this vastly superior force, only 30 miles from the Canadian border in freedom, Chief Joseph was surrounded in the Bear Paw Mountains of northern Montana. After a 5-day battle, only 87 of his warriors remained. Rather than risk the lives of the surviving 350 women and children, Joseph chose to surrender.
1. Verified. TP.
5. Chief Joseph's speech at the surrender to General Howard, October 5, 1877.
1. Verified as Captain Wood's account of Joseph's surrender. If I may, a personal reaction here. This seems to offer a clear mythologizing, i.e. expansion, of Chief Joseph's authentically heroic struggle. We're asked to believe that a pilgrimage to consult with some totemic deity, perhaps one of the sky people referenced earlier, gave Joseph the power to travel through mountains and create traveling clouds of smoke to misdirect their enemies. He seems to be referring to the same or a similar location earlier visited by Lewis, which prompted the hallucinogenic encounter he wrote about to Jefferson, allegedly in the Twin Peaks vicinity. For the record, let me state that I am secular and skeptic by nature. Intimations of the supernatural are always easier to report or suggest than verify, particularly with events that took place over 150 years ago. Show me the science, please. TP.
Thus ended the last war between the United States and a Native American nation.
Tell General Howard I know his heart. What he told me before, I have in my heart. I am tired of fighting. Our chiefs are killed. The old men are all dead. My brother who led the young men is dead. It is cold and we have no blankets. Our little children are freezing to death. My people, some of them have run away to the hills and have no blankets, no food. No one knows where they are, perhaps freezing to death. I want to have time to look for my children and see how many I can find. Maybe I shall find them among the dead. Hear me, my chiefs. I am tired. My heart is sick and sad. I have fought, but from where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever.
6. Statement by General Howard's adjutant, Captain Charles Erskine Wood. Joseph and 400 followers were taken on unheated rail cars to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where they were held in a prisoner of war camp for 8 months. The following summer, the survivors were taken by rail to a reservation in Oklahoma that was little more than a concentration camp. By that time, over half of the Nez Perce had died of epidemic diseases. For the next 31 years, Chief Joseph fought for his nation's cause and met with 3 different presidents to argue his case. Captain Erskine Wood, good as his word, tried to carry on the fight for justice for them. He resigned from the army, practiced law in Portland, and fought to get the matter before Congress. He eventually raised the money to bring Joseph to Washington to speak for himself.
1. Verified. TP.
Colonel Miles had had 2 conferences with Joseph before we arrived. In them, he had promised in clear terms that if Joseph surrendered, he and his people would be returned to their own country. If Miles promised this, it unavoidably became a condition of any surrender, that he must return the Nez Perce to their former lands. Every excuse made for not doing so, that it was for the welfare of the Indians, that the whites would take revenge on them, that it would bring on another Indian war, though perhaps good reasons in a way, clearly broke faith with the Indians and repudiated the conditions of the surrender. General Howard instructed me to take Chief Joseph as a prisoner of war into camp and see that he was well treated, but carefully guarded against escape. I had Chapman translate this to Joseph, and I nodded pleasantly to the chief and tried to look as if it were all friendly. I beckoned him to come with me, and he promptly came forward, and we started to walk back. When we reached his tent, I told him I myself would see him again. I wished him good luck and hoped his troubles were over, and then left him. It will be observed that, true to Indian custom, Joseph had not spoken for any of his other chiefs. That night, Chief Whitebird, with his family and a few of his band, escaped and finally joined Sitting Bull in Canada. General Howard maintained that by permitting this escape, Joseph had violated the terms of surrender, and so the government was no longer bound to return the Indians to their own land. General Howard and I constantly differed on his position. He maintained that he had no authority to make any specific terms, that it was entirely up to the Secretary of War and the President, and that Joseph had violated the terms in permitting Whitebird to escape. I never have thought and do not now think these arguments sound. Before he departed from the camp, the mountain man Johnson told me the white man had awoken powerful medicine in Nez Perce territory by violating the many promises made to Chief Joseph. As a result, for the people who established claims and settled in the stolen Nez Perce territory, he claimed there would someday come a reckoning.
7. Speech made by Chief Joseph in Lincoln Hall, Washington, D.C., 1879.
1. All verified. A more profound definition of the meaning of freedom is hard to imagine. T.P.
My friends, I have been asked to show you my heart. I'm glad for a chance to do so. It does not require many words to speak the truth. I want the white people to understand my people. Some of you think an Indian is just like a wild animal. I will tell you about my people, and then you can judge whether an Indian is a man or not. I believe much trouble and blood would be saved if we open our hearts more. It does not require many words to speak the truth. My name is Mutuyalatlat, thunder traveling over the mountains. I am chief of the Wallamwatkin band of Chutpulu, or the Nez Perce. I was born 38 winters ago. My father was chief before me. He died a few years ago. He left a good name on earth. The first white men of your people who came to our country were named Lewis and Clark. They brought many things which the people had never seen. They talked straight, and our people gave them a great feast as proof that their hearts were friendly. They made presents to our chiefs, and our people made presents to them. We had many horses of which we gave them what they needed, and they gave us guns and tobacco in return. All the Nez Perce made friends with Lewis and Clark. Our chiefs told them how to speak to the Great Spirit Chief about many mysteries of our land. With his blessing, my people agreed to let them pass through this country and never to make war on white men. This promise the Nez Perce have never broken. Our fathers gave us many laws, which they had learned from their fathers. These laws were good. They told us to treat all men as they treated us, that we should never be the first to break a bargain, that it was a disgrace to tell a lie, that we should speak only the truth, that it was a shame for one man to take from another his property without paying for it. We were taught to believe that the Great Spirit sees and hears everything, and that he never forgets, that hereafter he will give every man a spirit home according to his deserts. If he is a good man, he will have a good home. If he is a bad man, he will have a bad home. This I believe, and all my people believe the same. If the white man wants to live in peace with the Indian, he can live in peace. There need be no trouble. Treat all men alike. Give them the same laws. Give them all an even chance to grow and live. All men were made by the Great Spirit Chief. He has made his heart known to me. We are all brothers. The earth is the mother of all people, and all people should have equal rights upon it. You might as well expect all rivers to run backward, as that any man who was born a free man should be contented, penned up, and denied liberty to go where he pleases. I have asked your great white chiefs where they get their authority to say to an Indian that he shall stay in one place while he sees white men going where they please. They cannot tell me. I only ask to be treated as all others are treated. If I cannot go to my own home, let me have a home in a country where my people do not die so fast. When I think of our conditions, my heart is heavy. I see men of my own race treated as outlaws, driven from country to country, or shot down like animals. We only ask to be recognized as men. Let me be a free man, free to travel, free to work, free to trade where I choose, free to follow the religion of my fathers, free to talk, think, and act for myself. I will obey every law or submit to the penalty. When the white man treats the Indian as they treat each other, we shall have no more wars. We shall all be brothers of one father and mother, with one sky above us and one country around us, and one government for all. Then the great spirit chiefs who rule above will smile upon this land and send rain to wash out the bloody spots made by my brothers, wounds upon the face of the earth. For this time, the Indian race is waiting and praying. In Mutu Yalatlat, Chief Joseph.
Archivist note. In an agonizingly slow response to Joseph's appeal, 6 years later, his people were allowed to move from Indian territory in Oklahoma to a reservation in Washington. Once they arrived, the Nez Perce discovered they would be forced to live alongside the broken remnants of 11 other tribes.